Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
The Telegraph. The Telegraph. Podcasts.
He's going to score under the post. JJ Williams. The Lions leap in the air.
These are the days that you never believe will come again.
To win for a Lion, for the Lions in a test match, is the ultimate.
Just a draw!
Hello and welcome to Full Contact with the Telegraph and this mini-series Brian's Lions over the course of the next few weeks as we build up to the 2021 Lions Tour South Africa. I'll be speaking to the great and the good of Lions Tours gone by, and for our second instalment I'll be discussing what it's like to face the Lions and the pressure of facing a side you can only ever play once every 12 years. I'm delighted to say joining me all the way from the other side of the world is the former South African captain and World Cup winner and series winner in 2009. It's John Schmidt. Hello, John.
How are you doing, Brian? You well?
I'm not too bad, mate. Look, we've gone at length about why it's special over here to be a Lion, and it really is. I know that from personal experience, but I'd like to get the opposing point of view. Is it special to play against the Lions still, even in this world of professionalism and the ubiquity of the World Cups? If it is so, why is that so?
I think it's become more special, Brian, just because of how the game has changed commercially, and we look at all these tournaments and things that happen annually all the time. I mean, I look just to the fact that we play the All Blacks we play the All Blacks three times a year. I think if there's anything that is sort of the last of the traditional way of rugby when it comes to touring and facing a team, it's got to be this British and Irish Lions opportunity. So for us, it's 12 years. For you blokes, it's every 4 years. But there's something extremely special around being able to get your timing right, get your injuries right. Yeah. It's much harder to play against a Lions team than it is to make a World Cup.
Well, I'll tell you what, you played on two separate tours. We'll go into the 2009 very much in detail. But let's go back to 97. You're a young pro then, about 19, somewhere thereabouts. You spent a small part on the tour, didn't beat the test team, but what are your memories of that series?
Well, you see, that was the first taste I ever had of professional rugby. I was in my second week in the premier team of the Natal Sharks at the time. I've been basically pulled out, Brian, because I think there were about 17 injuries. Robbie Kempson had been banned for beating up someone again, and so I don't think there was anyone else, and so I got called up the week before, and then this was the second opportunity, and I was up against the Lions, and I got a few minutes, and Dai Young came up to me afterwards and wanted to swap jerseys, but I didn't know if I'd ever play for the Sharks again, and this was a one-off jersey which we were able to keep, so I said to him, I'd love to, but I really can't give this away. I might never play for the Sharks again. And he was quite taken aback. And when he took the story back, it was good old fun bus Jason Leonard, who waltzed over about 20 minutes later and actually handed me his jersey and wished me luck for my career. And that, I think, is when I truly realized the significance and the uniqueness of rugby union as a sport.
We are delighted to be here. The Lions back in South Africa after 12 years, a very evocative series that lie ahead of us, and we're looking forward to it. We've had a good week in camp already before coming here, and that's been very successful, and we'd like to think that it's going to continue to be successful over the next week before we play our first game.
Let's move on to 2009. To set the context, you're reigning world champions, but you're coming off the back of a mixed 2008. You've got a new coach, Peter de Villiers. The Springboks had lost the series the previous time, the 12 years in 97. So what can you remember what you thought about when the Lions squad was announced? Any thoughts on that?
So for us, it was an opportunity for a lot of us older dogs who'd signed contracts overseas to make a decision as to what to do in terms of coming back. And Peter de Villiers was a massive moment in South African rugby, the first coach of colour in this country. And to be a part of that was one thing. And then to be a part of it and back up a World Cup win with the first coach of colour in a Lions series. So it was the one thing that brought us all back. Percy came back, I came back, Victor came back, and we took on this challenge. And so when the Lions touring squad was announced, we knew we were up against it. But the one thing that stood out for us, Brian, was around, it's one thing to pick a squad. It's an entirely different challenge to pick a starting 15. And to pick the right 15 is probably the biggest and most important factor for any Lions coach.
As you're on the other side of it, you're trying to get into the test team and you're trying to gauge on the way there, if I'm in the Saturday team or if I'm in this particular one, he's definitely going to play. So if I'm in the team that with him, does it mean I'm definitely going to play? But on the other side of it, you've got two decisions to make, haven't you? On the one hand, you can keep your powder dry and not play any test players, and then suddenly, bang, you get in there and the Lions are facing something that they've never seen before. Or you can say, well, look, we need to give them some time to play against the Lions, but then, they'll have played the players as well. How do you reckon the best way to go about it is? How do you do it on that occasion?
I think you can always delve into mistakes of the past. So you can learn from, I think, the things that have happened. And I think it's on the tours that you guys have got right. You've sort of stuck to your guns in terms of believing in what your best combination of 15 starters is.
Yep.
And then keeping those guys active enough in the matches before so that they're not physically unprepared, but also not killing them so that they are able to accept the onslaught of what's coming, which is three test matches. Bearing in mind, it's pretty much South Africa will keep all of their test players, most of the starting 15 out of any of those preamble games. And so, and then there's the tricky part about a coach getting wrapped up in his selection of his team by looking at what he thinks he might face against the Springboks. And it's this age-old thing that makes me laugh every time. And, everyone always talks about, you've got to be physical against Africa. But, I mean, it's been like that for 100 years.
It always
will be.
Yes.
So nothing's different. We're not a 40 offload team in 80 minutes. We're a pretty big, robust pack of forwards with a couple of backs who can do a few things out wide. But it really is, I think, for Lions coaches, it's about picking a team that he thinks can bring the best out of the British and Irish region and showing what that can do against the Springboks. To think about who you're going to play against Chez and Colby or who your front row is going to be because of what happened in the final 2 years ago, that I think sometimes can distract a coach from what he has in front of him.
Yeah, and also, if you're constantly second-guessing, you lose, to me, you lose sometimes the focus on what you need to do well first. Let's play that against that. Let's get our thing right first. So if we don't get our thing right first, it doesn't matter who plays, because it's not going to be good enough.
Oh, we were playing quite well. When we did what we wanted to do, we were getting over the gain line and we were opening them up a bit. And the more we did that, the stronger we grew. That was a very bad try to concede off the two mauls, and that hurt us badly. But the scores from the penalties killed us as well. I mean, geez, if a few of those tries had stuck, would have been game over and we would have won it,
I read recently that you said you were more nervous for the first test, the build-up for 2009, than you were for the World Cup final. Is that right?
Yeah, mate, there was so much riding on that first test. And remember, the reason why for my nerves were so much higher than usual is that I'd gone from being a hooker in this 07 World Cup to being the tight head for the series. And, I pretty much knew, and that's why I speak about selection. For me, when they announced the first team, and take nothing away from Githen, I was delighted Geffen was selected at Lucid because I could think of nothing worse than facing Andrew Sheridan. You know, it would have taken a lot away from the Lions' ability to play around the park, but it would have been a nightmare for me. So, you know, for me, the first bit of a breath of fresh air was the fact that I didn't have to face the beast of Andrew Sheridan.
Yeah.
But it was a massively nervous time for me as an individual because of what we're riding on, what had happened 12 years ago, and the fact that I was playing out of position.
Well, funnily enough, I mean, if my recollection is right, I'm certain it is, the scrum was a vital part of that. In my opinion, it shouldn't have been that way around. But you've mentioned your delight at not having to play Sheridan, and I understand that. It seems to me that South Africa, above everyone else, are able to turn scrum domination into real points, into real domination around the field. Now, is that a constant technique? Is it a mindset? Is it right?
Well, Brian, I think you'll enjoy my answer to this more than most. But you know, back a long, long time ago, South African packs of forwards did whatever it took to intimidate and fight the opponent. I mean, it was tough to play in the 70s and 80s and even the 90s. When I was a kid, I got smashed up as a kid.
Yeah.
And the scrum is the last legal form of warfare in the modern game. I mean, there's cameras on everyone at every angle, you know. So the scrum is the last place where you can actually get in the ring and smash a right hook and see what happens to the opponent. And South Africans get a massive amount of confidence out of that warfare situation, as you well know. So and the reason why it's still such a loved part of the game, and I go around to kids and I always have to give them a sort of a safety first on scrums, but it is something that you are taught to love from an early age. So the scrum is the last part of warfare that's allowed and legal, and it's the one thing that allows you to get the first punch in, Ryan. You know, the game has never started until that first scrum comes, and if you win that first blow, it's a massive, massive confidence gainer.
And it's the one area where you can't avoid it. You know, you can move lineouts around to shuffle players. You can move defenders around. You can't move scrummages around. You can't move those around. I absolutely agree with you. And Ben, and the sooner people understand that psyche, you know, and what it means, the better. And I hope they do this time, just for completeness sake and to make it a contest. I spoke to Ian McGeachan about how he managed his squad in the week after that test, because the difference between facing a second test when you've won and when you've lost, completely different. On the one hand, you've got backs to the wall, and you haven't got it to do it better. So you've come off the first one. You're happy. Narrowish win. Could have been bigger, probably. 26-21. You're going to a second test. What's the message?
We knew that we'd been pretty comfortable the first sort of 50 minutes. Things definitely changed. The momentum changed. And the Lions actually got, I reckon, finished that game thinking, hey, hang on a sec. We just needed a bit of time together. And, you know, this is really, we're on the right track here. So we knew we were going to be up against it in the second test. And so our approach to the second test was, we want to start as fast as possible. We want to move everything. We want to get the ball through the hands. We want to go side to side. We want to just try and throw as much Super Rugby kind of flavor at the game in the first 20 minutes as possible. But that was thrown off the track when Skalk Berger got sent off in the first 30 seconds. So then we went from preparing the whole week to speed things up and just take the tempo to another level, to slowing things down, playing for time, walking to lineouts, and then we just couldn't get out of that rut. So that first 40 was probably the hardest 40 I've had to manage as a captain. You know, we got properly stuck in at halftime in terms of getting guys to wake up and stick back to the plan and revert, sort of restart the test match. But probably the most amazing, most intense test match I've ever been a part of, a roller coaster of momentum and emotions throughout that 80.
Yeah, the guys are delighted. I think it was a test match that probably could. I don't think we've ever had a worse start to a test match. And, you know, we're really focusing the whole week on finishing it up this week. And, you know, the way it started seemed like a tall task. So, some firm words at half time, but some great words at full time. So, happy. Close in the end, but delighted with the result. I think they took a lot of heart out of how poor we were in the last 20 minutes last week. And they certainly brought the game to us.
He's gone down as one of the most intense and ferocious of all time. You'd have to go back to a few of the unrefereed games earlier on to look at, you know, right in the past to make a comparison. But look, The Lions seem to sort a number of things there. Look, we can't avoid this. I mean, you've got the Backes incident and you've got the Berger incident. When those happened, especially the Berger one, do you think he was going off or not?
See, I hadn't seen that incident. I think it was just on the kickoff, you know. So yeah. I hadn't seen the incident, and I didn't actually know what I was defending, but I was defending with everything I had inside of me to the referee.
Yeah.
You know, so look, it was his 50th game as well. So you can imagine the emotions of the second test. He's running out first as well in his 50th mm-hmm. game. And so I guess in hindsight, that with this, you know, you didn't have the referee, the TV ref, and all that kind of thing happening at the time. It was certainly the worst kind of start we could ever have planned for.
I remember this. I remember distinctly. Ron Agora decides to kick the ball. We're right at the end. And I remember saying afterwards, of all the things that he could have done, there was only one thing that he shouldn't have done. And he could have done anything else, and it'd have been okay. He could have coped with it. But he did the one thing he shouldn't have done. And, of course, the rest is history. But I think that was a hell of a kick from Morney Stane, wasn't it? A lot of people, you know, people sort of think, oh, it was a definite. Well, it wasn't, was it?
I wasn't going to Mornay to begin with, Brian. I was actually looking for France, Spain.
Yeah.
And Mornay came to me and said, this is my hometown. I know I can make this. And he gave me a little wry smile. I was crapping myself inside, to be fair, and so grateful that I wasn't the guy that had to take the kick. But he literally stepped up and took the decision away from me, and I said, all yours, mate.
That's what you want, isn't it? That's great. Blame him later. He asked for it. Yeah. You've won a test series. You've got the revenge for 97. What's the feeling like for that?
The last time we felt that good was in Paris 2 years ago.
Yeah.
We stayed at a place called Monty, just down the road from Loftus. And you know, they actually rented out the entire Tops sort of area for us. And it was, you know, beers and cigars. And it was, I tell you what, it was almost like, I think we needed it to vindicate what we'd done 2 years ago because of the iffy 2008 that we had and the fact that, you know, we got through a World Cup without beating the All Blacks. And so those sort of demons sort of hang around. So to be able to back it up in terms of being able to leave a real legacy behind around a World Cup and a Lions series, that was really what fueled our excitement and happiness for that result.
And of course, you've got the De Villiers dimension as well.
For sure. I mean, Peter was a revelation for us as a group. You know, he was the right guy at the right time. We were a bunch of old blokes who'd been around the block, hard to teach sort of old dogs new tricks. He could have come in there and tried to change everything up, but he actually worked with us as people and got his little bits and pieces in between there, where, you know, by treating us like a group of settled players mm-hmm. who didn't really want to change a hell of a lot. So, it couldn't have been a better combination in terms of his timing with us. You know, I think there are a number of other coaches that would have come in there and tried to put their blueprint on a group like that, and it would have been a disaster. So it was fantastic.
How did that work? Because people have got to understand the changing nature politically, rugby politically in South Africa. You know, it takes swings here and there. Sometimes it goes in a direction that people all agree is right. Sometimes it doesn't. And of course, any initiative can go wrong and set it back, or it can go right like this one did. Do you think that had a kick-on effect for the inclusiveness, for the diversity programme and the legitimacy of that?
Look, Brian, to give an accurate answer to that is going to take a long time. But what I will say is that this country has got, you know, a very interesting path with a past, with a lot that has been done, you know, if we look at the 70s and 80s. But for us to be able to have been such a young democracy, and rugby in the beginning, without a doubt, was an icon of apartheid. You know, the Springbok was a team that was for whites only, and we're talking the 70s, 80s. That's not a long time ago. So, the amount of progress that we as a team have made in terms of what it represents in South Africa when it comes to winning 3 World Cups, and we look at that 2019 team of representation. Peter de Villiers was a massive part of that transformation and people to accept. And remember, Springbok coach in this country is probably the most contestable title to have.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't get a Springbok coach that's loved by everyone. It's always 13 different camps. So add color into that as well. It was imperative to everyone involved to support Peter and make it work. And he knew that as well, you know. And it's funny, you know, when he was managing players, he would almost be harder on the players of color than anyone else, because mm-hmm. he didn't want to be seen to be this token coach of color. And there isn't one person in that 4-year stint with Peter de Villiers that'll say a bad word about Peter. Every single guy there had probably one of the best 4-year periods of their life under his tutelage. So it was one of the very, very important steps in the transformation of what the Springboks means to South Africans in this country. And one has to attribute that as one of the factors that allowed for us to see this very transformative team in 2019.
For me and for everybody, this is sport. This is what it's all about. This is great, you know. So if everything is clear-cut in the environment that we are all in, we shouldn't try and prepare even. What people think and what people say that to us is their opinion, and we honor their opinion, but it doesn't mean that we will all agree with them. And I think you share that sentiment.
It's all wrapped up. You head into the third test, the final game, dominated by the bans for Scott Berger for the eye contact on Luke Fitzgerald and Backes Botha, who I think, of all the times that Backes could have been banned and should have been banned, this probably wasn't one of them. And I remember, who was behind the Justice 4 armband?
Yeah, that was an interesting week. You know, it actually started the morning after the celebration on the Sunday, because Peter came to me and he wanted to obviously change up the team and use everyone and give everyone a chance to be part of the Lions series. And truth be told, I wasn't a fan of that idea. I could understand the value that he wanted to give everyone an opportunity. And so we had a difficult Sunday in terms of that, and invariably I lost that argument. So it was always going to be a very different starting lineup. Bans to Skulk and Buckies played into the hands of all those changes for the third test. But you know the Justice for All, that was a big call from us, you know, because you're right. I think of all the guilty actions of Buckies Botha, it was probably, if you were going to make a video textbook of how to clean up, that would probably be the best clip you could use. You know, again, that caused a huge amount of disruption. I think I spent a good part of 4 or 5 hours on an online arbitration with some, I think it was a Canadian or Australian judge who had absolutely no idea of what a clean out was. So that added to my frustration. But either way, it was just us trying to make a point.
We spoke to Ian McGeachan, who told us how important he felt it was for the Lions to win the third test so that the touring side 4 years later inherited a winning jersey. Because he and I, we're big on the Lions, you know, being custodian of the shirt every 4 years. You get your time in the sun to have your Lions bit, but what goes before and what comes after, you know, that's someone else's responsibility. So if you want to be seen as a good Lion, you leave the shirt as well as it can be, knowing that you're only a temporary occupant of it ever. And he said that he was absolutely desperate to do that. Can you remember the feeling, you know, after the final whistle, you'd lost? What sort of camaraderie, if any, was there between the teams?
Well, let me first start by saying, you know, even if I truly believe, even if we picked a full strength team, well, the team that had been successful in the first two tests, it was too tight. That test series result was too tight. It wouldn't have been a fair reflection of the two teams on display for it to be 3-0. It was that close. I mean, that second test, it just doesn't get any closer. And as far as the camaraderie, it was probably one of the things that I felt could have been better. If I look back to the 97 and what happened there, and I had a small brief encounter. But, you know, we actually sent out an invite to the British and Irish Lions management weeks before they arrived to invite them into our change room after every test match just to share a beer. And they sadly declined. So we actually didn't ever have any opportunity to make any friends. So, you know, the only relationships I've got with some of those players are the ones that I've made through the internationals between each of their countries. But they almost went out of their way to stay away from us for that 3 weeks, Brian, which I thought was disappointing.
And again, back to South Africa as head coach with the ultimate goal of continuing what we've built on and also continuing to build the brand and how important that is. I think the Lions is, like I said, it's unique, it's incredibly special, and I want this brand to continue to thrive and to go on and to be a huge part of the rugby community.
Well, look, let's take this tour. Similar to 97, you're coming into the tour as reigning world champions. Haven't played a game since the final in 2019, and of course, the most atypical of times in terms of coronavirus and who will be playing where and what and how and so on. What is the anticipation like for the tour, the appetite for it in South Africa at the moment?
The appetite has been phenomenal since before we won the World Cup 2 years ago. What to expect? No one has a clue. With South Africans, as you well know, common sense is probably the least of our qualities. So everyone expects it to be a resounding success. We've got a couple of challenges. You know, our team hasn't played in 2 years. It'll probably be the same squad that played 2 years ago. But the excitement here is phenomenal. I mean, what a time to be a pundit, because you can't be wrong, because no one's got a clue what's going to happen.
Exactly. No one's got a clue. Look, it's going to be played behind closed doors. Your boys won't have any experience of that, will they? No, the test side, certainly.
Test side, definitely not. Obviously, we've had our boys playing locally here behind, you know, in front of empty stadiums. And I, you know what? I think it's probably the saddest thing lost with the series. Because yeah. I'll never forget, Brian, when I ran out in Durban, my home ground, and I was like beaming with pride and waiting for this massive welcome, and I got the sea of red. It's an experience you just cannot replicate anywhere else. And I feel for our guys that they're not going to experience that, because that red army is something special. So. Yep. If anything, you know, it's going to take away from the intensity of what this occasion brings.
Razzy Erasmus, you know, what do you think of the job, you know, he's done with the side? For those who might not have seen too much South African rugby, what can we expect from them?
Look, I don't think that they can stray too far away from what they did 2 years ago.
I agree.
Razzy and Jacques are very much a processes-driven group and team. They've kept the players busy, but I don't think that there's been too much opportunity to introduce anything massively new in terms.
Why would they need to as well?
And that's probably why he's going to stick to the group that he knows best.
Yeah,
you've got a lot of youngsters that have come through and shown something exciting, but it's just too big a deal, the Lions series, to experiment anyone that hasn't been part of that group already with Razzy and Jar.
So we're coming down to this. They've seen the Lions squad selection. Were there any surprises? You know, not for me. There were one or two people who you said, well, he could have been in, he maybe not. I can't make a case out for many of the players who have been picked to not be picked. So, you know, it's a decent squad that's coming over. Any thoughts about it?
I feel for Carl Sinclair.
Yes, I do, yeah.
I don't think he would have started. I think Taj would have always started the test matches. But I think he would have been a significant impact player to come off the bench. So I think he can be fair. Billy, I guess, is the other name. But, I mean, you know, Billy hasn't had a great track record against Dwayne Vermeulen in all the test matches that he's played against. You know, that's probably a smart decision, albeit hard. Other than that, I thought it was a really good selection. You know, my only maybe concern would be, you know, have they got enough loose heads there to stand up to the array of tight heads that are going to be coming up against them? That's probably going to be key.
Well, in terms of how the test series pans out, I mean, you've already prefaced this. There isn't a lot that's going to be new to me. You know, if the Lions don't get their first principles right in the set piece and accuracy around the breakdown, they can forget anything else. You know, and probably vice versa, because, you know, we all know where this is done. But to me, of all the sides, if you don't get your set piece right against South Africa, you will pay. Because they're the sort of side who just say, we'll keep doing it. So what, we don't care, really. You know, we've got all these weapons outside, Chaz, and well, you can have the ball later when we've ground them into the dust, and you can play with the ball, you know, when we give it to you. But until now, we'll have 50 minutes, and you can f*** off, actually. But so I don't think, you know, I think it will be on that level. I just wonder how quickly South Africa can get back into that sort of, you know, super efficient mode without test intensity. We'll just see about that.
That is the biggest risk. I think that's probably the one thing that will be a concern to the coaching staff as well. How, you know, to get into that sort of test match intensity, set piece, physicality breakdown, it doesn't come overnight.
Having attended so many by proxy and, you know, just as one of only a few people allowed into a stadium, it is a weird sensation. And it is difficult, I think, sometimes to motivate yourself. And that will be interesting because a lot of the players, you know, all the home internationals players have played big games, you know, big Six Nations games in front of nil crowds at the Millennium stadium where, you know, you're echoing around. And it is a bit weird. And South Africa, be interested in the first test, you know, to see how they cope with it, because it's not normal.
Look, it's definitely not normal. I've been to a few games as a pundit, and it's eerie. It's horrible. I could think of nothing worse than playing in front of absolutely nothing. And the other thing that would worry me, and purely selfishly as a hooker / guy that's in charge of the lineups, is the opposition hears every single thing you say. You know, you've got to think about all your calls. You've got to think about how you don't allow them to decode your lineup format. It's just so many more things for these players to be aware of than in our time.
Who do you think who do you think are favourites?
I would, you know, it's an old story, and Jake always used to do this before every test, and he got him into a spot of bother with Ireland back in 2005, I think it was. But you got to put down the starting 15, what you think is going to play for the Lions, and then put down your starting 15, which will probably be very close to what you saw in Tokyo. And then you sort of look and see which guys would be able to filter through both teams. And if your number is stronger on the Lions side, there's your favourite. And if it's on the box side, there's my favourite. So that's I think, an exercise that every pundit should probably do from both sides to try and give a neutral view on favourites.
That works sometimes. Did you ever hear the England story with Clive Woodward about them facing New Zealand? And he said, look down the hall, but and look down at us. There's not one player I would swap. And tentative hand got cover for the back. Said, can we swap Austin Healey for Jonah Lomu, please? Which is a fair point.
It's like, Brian, it's when Stephen de Blanche played his first test against the All Blacks. Yeah. And the night before, he's crapping himself. And he says to Gary Tash, he says, what should I do, you know, in the haka? What should I do? So he says, you know what? When you look at your opposition in the eye, you find him. And you just stare him down. You let him know you're coming for him for 80 minutes. So his eyes grew bigger and bigger. And Tash said, so who are you playing against? He goes, Jonah. He says, don't do that with Jonah. You can take Randall.
Johnny, but I tell you what, the real pity is, you know, I'm not out there to tap you up for a beer afterwards, you know, and so no one else is. And that's, as I say, we preface this, that's a real shame. But let's hope that the series, apart from that, comes off with a lot of integrity. Let's hope the games are great. Let's hope, you know, that they're close and so on. Thank you very much, mate.
Pleasure, Brian. Go well, mate.
Take care. Bye-bye. Well, that's all we have time for. A huge thank you to John Schmidt for speaking to me, especially in the unguarded and candid manner that he did. You don't always get people who are like quite as honest as that. Look, remember to subscribe to the Full Contact podcast. And remember this, subscription is not about paying. It just means registering. So just tell you what, remember to register for the Full Contact podcast channel to keep up to date with all episodes during the Lions tour this summer. You'll also find last week's episode of Brian's Lions with the great Sir Ian McGeachan, and that's there too. For now, though, it's goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinis. I'm Kayla Itzinis, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.